Imagine a conversation, if you will, between God and Adam going something like this. God says, Adam, what do you think of this beautiful garden I've put you in? All the trees, the flowers, the wonderful different kinds of animals. Adam says, it's a wonderful place, God, but I've noticed that every other animal has someone with it. They all come in pairs. God said, yes, I've noticed that too. I'll make you a woman, Adam. She'll be beautiful. She will be the delight of your eyes. She will cook for you. She will clean for you. She will sew your clothes. She will wash your clothes. She will iron your clothes. She will always laugh at all your jokes. She will scratch your back. In everything and in every way, she will do everything she can to make you feel like a king. Adam says, wow, what'll that cost me? God said, well, an arm and a leg. Adam says, whoa, that's a lot. What can I get for a rib? Those of you who have, I apologize to those of you who have endured my premarital counseling. I start a session off with that joke. It's an old one, but it's a good one. And unfortunately, there's a lot of truth to it. We live in a sin-cursed world. There are no perfect marriages. Let me say that again. There are no perfect marriages. Never have been, never will be. And so what Adam was looking for did not exist after the curse. He had it before the curse. As I listen to the reading of the Word of God this morning, every time I read this passage, I hear church bells and see a march, don't you? Here's Adam. He has had the job of naming all the animals, and as he names one after another, after another, after another, he notices that they are paired. Here comes male and female elephant, and male and female bear, and male and female spider. I guess maybe there isn't one of those. Anyway, he sees all the pairs as the animals come by, and the longer Adam works that day, the lonelier he gets. So finally, at the end of the day, God puts Adam into a deep sleep, and as Adam comes back from the anesthetic, he wakes to see the most beautiful creature that God has made yet. And he goes, wow. She's not fuzzy like the bears. She's not scaly like the fish. She's not feathery like the birds. She's like Adam. She's like me. And he rejoices, and God brings her to Adam. And we have a description here of this first wedding, and I believe it was a wedding that took place that day between Adam and Eve as God presided and was the witness of it. We're in a series we call Foundations. As we study God's Word, these first dozen chapters in the book of Genesis, we're looking at foundations of the first 1,500 years of human existence. We're looking at what God has established for our culture. We learned 2 weeks ago that God created mankind in his image. He created male in his image. He created female in his image. Male alone is not in the image of God. Male and female are in God's image. He created them in the image of God. We saw last week that there was a perfect world for a very short period of time, and we saw some principles from that perfect world. I really believe that everything in chapter 2 fits into day 6. And therefore, the comment that we find at the end of chapter 1, where it says, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, includes Eve. Okay, guys? God did a perfect thing there. And even marriage is perfect in its original creation as God makes it, and the comment that God makes at the end of Genesis 1 applies to everything in Genesis chapter 2, including this institution that we have called marriage. There's another hermeneutical tool that I'd like us to consider this morning. It's something that I don't read or hear about much lately, but something I learned as a kid back at Regular Baptist Press, and that is something called the law of first mention. It's a tool for thinking about the Word of God. And briefly, the law of first mention says this: the first time that God mentions a topic in the Bible, He often gives us the parameters for that topic from this time forward. And I truly believe that applies to marriage in this case. The verses that were read this morning concerning marriage are the foundation of marriage and truly impact everything else in the Bible about marriage. Moses does not negate this truth when he writes later in the book of Deuteronomy. Jesus and Paul will quote from this text and use it as the foundation of what they will teach concerning marriage. And so if we would know the foundation of marriage in our culture, the foundation of marriage as mankind, we need to come to Genesis chapter 2. In our sin nature, we tend to look at the what ifs. We like to look for the exceptions rather than the rule. This morning, I would like us to look at the rule. Here is a foundation, both because it happened before sin, marriage precedes sin, but also because of the fact that God establishes these principles here, first time He mentions marriage. Let's look and see what are the foundations of marriage, or what would be the components or truths about a great marriage this morning. And first, on your outline, I'd like to simply state, God made marriage. That's getting a lot of hits today. Marriage is not a human invention. We cannot attribute the characteristics of what we call traditional marriage to the prejudices of a patriarchal society. We cannot claim that marriage is optional, unneeded by our sophisticated modern man or postmodern man. We cannot believe that there is something better that man could invent to take its place. God made marriage. We cannot claim that marriage is whatever we want it to be. We can't make up the rules of marriage on our own. There are no open marriages. God made marriage. And in this marriage that God made, I see that first a need is met. It is noted in verses 18 to 21 that marriage fulfilled a need, and in this case, the need was loneliness. Adam was single. He was by himself, and God said, there's a need here, and I'm going to meet that need. Marriage is made to make us better. Marriage improves us. Now, I realize that God has given a gift of being single to some people. Paul talks about that gift that he and perhaps others had. But God saw a need in Adam's life and gave Eve to Adam to meet that need. I come back again to the first words ever recorded by a human man found in verse 23. The King James doesn't, I think, give the full emphasis or the emotion of the Hebrew. Let me read the New Living Translation to you. At last, the man exclaimed, this one is bone from my bone and flesh from my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken from man. Eureka! I found it! At last! I've got it! She's like me! This emotion is found in the Hebrew, and it's truly what Adam erupted on this day. After seeing bear and trout and sparrows, Adam was beside himself with joy to see Eve. Husbands need to remember that fellowship with his wife, fellowship with your wife, is a treasured gift from God, something that God has given, provided to meet your need. A second need that is met by a great marriage is sexual purity. In 1 Corinthians 7, verses 2 to 9, Paul will say that sexual purity is one of the purposes of marriage. We'll come back to that text. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says of a husband that he should give himself for the holiness of his wife, the way that Christ does for the church. We know that Jesus Christ died, that we might be redeemed, and that he ever lives as a minister of our sanctification. So a husband should die to himself and ever live for the sanctification of his wife. The purpose of your marriage is not to make you happy. The purpose of your marriage is to make you holy. God made marriage, and in that great marriage that God made, a need of man was met. I see another principle of marriage, and that is that one woman was brought to one man in this marriage that God made. God here established this precedent. God could have made another man before he made Eve. But he didn't. God could have brought two women to Adam, but he didn't. God could have brought Adam a child. God could have declared a whole clan, a tribe of people, to be one flesh. God could have created Eve first and then brought Adam, or maybe two men, to Eve. But he didn't. God had many, many options, but God did none of these. God brought one woman to one man and declared that they were husband and wife. God made marriage. And in this marriage that God made, a need of man was met. One man was brought to one woman, and man and woman were declared to be different. Twice in this text, we find these words, a helpmeet, King James, New King James, a helper comparable. I see roles here. Woman was created for a purpose. Eve was created by God as a compatible helper, an appropriate person for Adam. Women are not like men. Women are not the same as men. The noticeable differences distinguishing male and female leads to spiritual directives still applicable to us today. Husbands and wives have different spiritual responsibilities. Different spiritual responsibilities. I'm not talking about the stereotypical things. I'm not saying that women were created to cook and play the piano and men were created to work on cars and spit. Cultural chauvinism must not be part of our theology. Let me say that again. Cultural chauvinism cannot be part of our theology. It is unbiblical and heretical to teach that women ought not be athletes and men ought not be tender. It is also unbiblical to erase the responsibilities that God has specifically given to husbands and wives. Husbands are to bear the headship responsibility of the family. Wives are to complete what is missing in their husband in their submission to his leadership. This does not preclude women from excelling outside the home. This does not insinuate that men are smarter or wiser. I can think of many marriages where I think perhaps the wiser or smarter person is the wife. It does not mean that women are not qualified for leadership. What it does mean is God has given, again, the responsibility to bear the headship, to bear the responsibility of leadership to the man. Foundation of marriage, the great truths of marriage we see in this text. First, I see that God made marriage. Second, I would like to see in this text that God has assigned unique qualities to marriage. And again, I apologize to those of you who have sat under my ministry or have been in my premarital counseling classes, but it's so hard to get away from what is here in verse 24 in any other way. I believe there are three things in verse 24 that are not true of any other relationship. They're not true of a father-son relationship. They're not true of a sister-sister relationship. For there to be a great marriage, you must first leave. For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother. That speaks of separation. That speaks of going away from. You can't hang out with the guys the way you used to. You can't party with the singles group the same way. You can't do video games all night because now you have a wife to go home to. You can't run home to mommy every time she calls you. You can't let work dictate to send you just any place. You can't have opposite sex best friends like perhaps you used to have. I've committed in this world of technology, Skype, Facebook, emailing. I've committed to Lynn that I won't send private messages on Facebook to non-family women. A woman that I was once engaged to 26 years ago has twice asked to be my friend on Facebook. She's still going by her maiden name, by the way. I have ignored her request both times and communicated with Lynn that this has happened. On the other hand, there's another woman that I dated 26 years ago who is married, three kids, a school nurse in Madison, an Awana worker, a Sparky worker in her church. Her sister is one of Lynn's best friends, and part of the school there in Wapaka that we both came out of. I am Sovai's friend on Facebook, but again, if Sovai ever sent me a private message on Facebook, I would do two things. Number one, I would tell Lynn, and number two, I would ignore it. Why? Because I'm going to make sure that I am separate to Lynn. And I'm not going to let the technology of this day and age in which we live. I will answer private emails to ladies in our church, but when those emails would cross the line from professional counseling issues to anything more than that, I will cease and I will copy my wife. In fact, often when I counsel ladies in our church who send me emails, I do carbon copy, you know, CC, and send it to Lynn too, because I'm separate. It's part of the leaving process. I refuse to have a friend that is closer than my wife. I especially refuse to have a female friend who's closer to me than my wife. Leaving means separation. Leaving means sanctification. That's the idea of not only going away from, but coming towards. This leaving has a purpose. I don't behave like a single man so that I can behave like a married man. Sometimes I will, this is maybe a shocker to everybody, including my wife, but sometimes I won't eat when I'm hungry so that I can eat when she is hungry. Why? Because there's a separation here. There's a sanctification here, a leaving to. I'm going to direct it to. There's smiles all over this room. Let the family, let people you work with know that you prefer your spouse. Don't get into the complain and gripe about my spouse habit. It happens so often in the workplace. Oh, my old man, he this. My old lady, he this. In today's world, used to be maybe where it was an all-male workforce. You could all complain about your wives, and that was relatively safe, though not beneficial. But in today's commingled workplace, you cannot gripe and complain about your spouse, for there will be somebody out there who would think that they might be the answer to your sadness. Let people in your family, let people you work with, know that you prefer your spouse. Don't speak in a manner or talk about your spouse in a manner that would put a crack in the oneness that you would show, that you would demonstrate before your friends and workmates. I won't let anyone set constraints upon my relationship with Lynn. I've determined that if anybody comes up to me and says, I'm going to tell you something, don't tell your wife, or maybe they tell me something and then say, now don't tell Lynn, I will, as God is my witness, do my very best to say, stop, then don't tell me, or too late, you shouldn't have told me that, because I can't promise you that I won't tell Lynn. Now there are things, I learned something exceedingly gross about a member of our church in the last 2 weeks, and so far I've told no one. Huh? Pretty good of me, huh? And I don't intend to tell Lynn or anyone else, because quite frankly, it wouldn't be beneficial to do so. There are things that, it's not that I tell Lynn everything, but I will not let anyone come between me and Lynn by trying to think that they have private information or they have a private road to me that my wife has nothing to do with. And therefore, if someone says, don't tell Lynn, then I'll say, stop, then don't tell me, because I'm not going to let you tell me what I can and cannot tell my wife. I don't believe married people should even go to a counselor by themselves long term. I understand there's times when a husband or wife may need to go to a counselor for some short answers, but it ought not stay long term. I've determined that that is a break in oneness, and that soon, quickly, into the counseling should be injected the other partner, because truly, and we'll get to the changing that happens in a spouse, truly, the beneficial changes that need to be made, both need to make if that marriage is to be restored or if that individual is to grow. For this cause shall a man leave. That means separation. It means sanctification. It means a certain singleness, and I'm stretching the alliteration here, but the idea of priority is what I'm looking for here. In your relationship, in all your relationships, marriage ought to be your priority relationship. It ought to be a priority over work. It ought to be a priority over habits. You know, model trains, Tom, can't be more important than Leanne. Nothing. Work, goals, objectives, habits. entertainment, the television. These things cannot be. There must be a single attraction that supersedes all other attractions. It is sin to allow anything or anyone to become more important to me than my spouse. If we'd rather be with someone else, and I don't mean all the time, I understand we are sinful, and quite frankly, everyone gets tired of everyone at some point or another. It's you get married so that you stay together long enough that you might fall in love again. I understand that you don't always feel married. You are married even if you don't feel married, right? But there's times when we don't, and therefore we need to be committed to each other, and I'm getting to that shortly. But if we'd rather be with someone other than our spouse, other than our mate, it is sin. It may not be physical adultery, but it is emotional adultery, and it's still adultery. And spouses need to positively express, communicate this truth to each other. Find ways of telling your spouse that whoever or whatever is second in your life is so far behind that it would be like what Jesus said when he said, unless you hate your father and mother, you cannot be my disciple. Jesus was not telling us to go spit at our mom and dad. He was simply saying our love for Christ ought to supersede our family love for our parents. And so our love and our commitment to our spouse ought to supersede everything else. A dedication to, a singleness. I had a couple in my office that was talking about their marriage, and her complaint was that every time his mother called, they went. And it ruined their own family life and social life because mama set the parameters of when they could be together and when they couldn't. This is wrong. Great truths about our marriage. First, God made marriage, and God set some unique qualities to marriage. And one of those things about a marriage that is a must is that we must leave. Second, in this text, we must cleave. For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife. That's a powerful word. Some alliteration here, promise. In that cleaving, there is promise. The vows we say at a wedding are to be a covenant. You give your word. To negate what you said that day is to be a liar. You said, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, in poverty and in wealth, and forsaking all others. That's what you said that day. To break those vows is a lie. Love is not a feeling. It's a decision of the will. To say, I don't love you anymore is really to say, I've decided that I choose to live a life without you because I think I would be happier. Sounds a little satanic, doesn't it? A little bit like Isaiah 14. I think I would be better off because I would be happier if I... This relationship is to keeps, is for keeps. To leave is to promise. It means there is permanence. The second P there. Threats of divorce or leaving the marriage are sin. It's our selfishness and unforgiveness are the only real reasons for divorce. Let me say that again. Selfishness and unforgiveness are the only real ultimate reasons for divorce. We are naturally selfish. It's part of our curse. And married folks must continually choose to prefer their spouse. Cleaving is created when both bring to that union a determination to prefer the other, to give 100% of themselves, to make their home a pleasant place, to actively bring to this union all of each. Love ought to be blind, ought not to be blind, but love ought to be loyal. Love needs to be committed. There needs to be permanence there. Cleaving will include promising and permanence. It will include persistence. In Ephesians 4, in his discussion on the body of Christ, Paul speaks of a love that is supplied by every joint. Love is not static. Marriage is not static. It is active and changing. Therefore, we must always work to keep a marriage upright and moving in the right direction. Peter speaks of studying your wife. I believe I read a translation, I think it's the NIV today, this week, where in that passage in 1 Peter, he says that you should be considerate. And I like that because the root word of that considerate is consider, that husbands should consider their wives, to think about what's going on in her life and to think about these things. Truths about marriage from Genesis 2. First, God made marriage. There's unique qualities that include leaving and cleaving. And then I always give Pastor Mattson the credit for coming up with this third word. I don't know where he got it from, but the word is weave. Leave, cleave, weave. The assonance that is in there is his. The one flesh. Like polyester and cotton, they are indistinguishable in a fabric. So in a marriage, husbands and wives should weave. They should be inseparable. And I truly believe that this is a formula, that 1 + 1 = 1. When you do the first two, you will weave, and you will weave socially. You will appear as one to your children. I'm sure all of you did this. I learned it from my folks. I believe Lynn learned it from her folks. But when your kids come to you and you say no, and then they go to the other parent, what should happen? Tell you what happened in our home. They got a spanking. No questions asked. If mom says no and you go ask dad, or dad says no and you go ask mom, that is rebellion. And we made sure the kids knew that at a very early age. We should appear as one to our children. I was doing premarital counseling with a couple, and I don't actually know how they ended up with this particular thing legally. But the couple asked me what I thought of hyphenated names, or perhaps even the woman leaving and keeping her maiden name. I said to them, I think it's sending the wrong message. I think it's here. We think of weaving, that you should appear as one. There is something about calling my grandma when I was a kid and have her answering the phone, Evangelist Curtis residence, Mrs. Curtis speaking. In the Wapaka Church cookbook, everybody else is, you know, Joan Buck or Jolene Gross. But Grandma, it's Mrs. Curtis. Grandma one time asked my mom, how come everybody else's recipes give their first and last name, and I'm the only one in the book called Mrs. Curtis? And Mom said, well, Mom, you always call yourself Mrs. Curtis. It would be almost like an insult for us to have put it any other way in the book. Well, I'm not so sure that we need to always be called by our last and surname, but there was something about the tradition that Grandma learned as a child where she considered herself Mrs. Evangelist Charles N. Curtis. And she wore that label proudly because they were one. Oh, sometimes they were like the Lockhorns, but don't take on either one of them, or you took on both of them. There was a certain tenacity that they had. I remember when the fuel guy that put fuel oil in their house spilled over the tank and stunk up their basement. There was going to be a lawsuit. They were so angry, and I tried to reason it. Well, they were unreasonable, but they were unreasonable together. Grandpa and Grandma, they weren't going to let anyone beat them. You should appear socially as one. It's part of the cleaving process. You should be financially as one. There was an older couple in our church when I first came here. She had three incomes. He had three incomes, you know, pension, Social Security, different things. And she took care of things and he took care of things. They had a divided financial house. It leads to all kinds of problems. I'm not saying it's sin for a husband and wife to have separate checkbooks, but they should be one in their knowledge. They should be one in their understanding. They should be one in their goals. They should be one in their priorities. There should not be a financial line that separates husbands and wives, and they should be one physically. Again, I truly believe that chapter 2 precedes the very good in chapter 1, and so sex precedes first sin. God says that sex is very good. Again, I see that most people, married people, would consider goals for their marriage as peace and happiness. And I would propose to you that these are selfish and shallow goals. I'm convinced now that the Bible, the biblical God-ordained goals for every marriage is oneness. And we should strive to that oneness. God does not want me to be at peace with my spouse. God wants me to be one with my spouse. Family life has this thing called Weekend to Remember.
Martins and others have promoted it. And when you go to a Weekend to Remember, they hand you this book that's about yay thick that you're going to go through between Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. By the way, we're going to have an opportunity on a Friday night and Saturday to do that here. We're going to talk about that more here in a minute. But in that Weekend to Remember curriculum, the first thing they talk about is our five threats to oneness. And they point out that only when a couple, a married couple, is one can they truly be godlike. We believe a lie. Listen to me. We believe a lie when we think we can be more spiritual single than we are married. That's a lie. And every once in a while, I believe it. You know, she drags me down. She does. You know, she wants to do this. And, you know, I want to read the Bible, and she wants to, you know, watch TV, or, you know, she drags me. That's a lie. That's a lie. It's a lie that I tell myself. And the truth of the matter is that only in my relationship with my wife can I truly grow in the Lord if I am married. If I am a married person, it's only as I have harmony in that horizontal level that I can grow. Those who would say, I am more spiritual now that I have broken or separated, that's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie. It's a lie they've believed in our culture, but it is a lie nonetheless. Lynn is not a hindrance to my spiritual growth. Rather, only when I am engaged in a relationship, engaged in a priority relationship with her, can I really understand God? Can I really be pushed, stimulated? Even the fact that she may grate on me is a file that might make me more like Jesus Christ. Three observations about oneness I would get from this text. I already introduced this, we'll come back again. I believe that weaving in oneness is sex. You can't get away from that. Because of the curse, sometimes man thinks that God has a problem with sex. The truth of the matter is that God created sex. And again, I say for the third time in this marriage, in this sermon, that God said it was very good. God said that about sex. Get that, teenagers, okay? God said that in a marriage, sex is very good. Look forward to it, anticipate it in all the parameters that God gives for it. Now I read 1 Corinthians 7, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have the authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his wife, over his body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except for with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come again together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Sex. Marriage sex is a natural and important part of marriage, and it is a spiritual part of marriage. You say, Dan, are you saying when you are thinking about that you're really thinking about God? No, no. But when I am thinking about sex with Lynn in a giving manner, it is a spiritual thing for me to do. It is the right thing for me to do. And it's a delightful thing for me to do. It is not a fringe benefit of marriage. It is not an option of marriage. It would be ridiculous for my right arm to withhold itself from my ear if it needs to be scratched. It is also ridiculous for a husband to withhold himself from the attention that is due his wife, even if all she needs is someone to listen. Marriage sex is spiritual. Sexual desires properly channeled will drive us to wholesome relationships. At the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, when Paul is talking about these things, you know, remember the passage where he says, and you know, I think being single is a good thing, he says there in that text. That's his advice. But he gets to the end. He says, you know, if you're going to burn, then and you're considered you're virgin, and I think in that text he's talking about a relationship. He says, then get married. And I see there that the sexual drive ought to drive good men and good women to a courtship that will end up in marriage. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I would propose to you that it's a good thing that that kind of oneness is desired by God and us. Weaving oneness is sex. Weaving oneness is safe. God created marriage. It should be safe. oneness in marriage is safe. So often when a couple comes to my office, this has been trashed. One or both of them has been hurt enough that they are willing to overcome the shame of confessing that they have a problem in this very close part of them, their marriage. And they're hurting bad enough that they're willing to overcome this shame to talk to a third person, to talk to me. And so often, because it has gone this far, there is so much damage that there's very little I can do. Soon I learned that one way or another, both of them are hurting. Sometimes they've hurt each other. Sometimes other people have hurt them. And when they begin speaking with each other like two wounded animals, they take defensive positions. Sins against them have caused them to learn defenses that sabotage their communication channels. Everything in our lives that would destroy oneness in a marriage and the safety that ought to be felt in that oneness ought to be hated and hunted down like a predator. Lies, anger, uncontrolled lust, arrogance, substance abuse, laziness. These things are all sin and ought to be labeled as sin and ought to be rooted out as the enemies of oneness that we are, that they are. Of all the things that a marriage and home ought to be and should be, it ought to be a safe place. We want to feel trust. Paul tells us that this kind of trust can happen in a marriage. Listen to him in Ephesians 5:29. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. You see, if I love me, and I do, then I'll take care of me. And I do to my own satisfaction, which isn't necessarily good. But I look out for me. And so Paul is teaching us here that so a husband ought to look out for his wife. I trust me. I know I won't purposefully, wrongfully hurt me. Solomon says a good wife is equally worthy of such trust. From that impossible woman text of Proverbs 31, let me read verse 11 where it says, the heart of her husband safely trusts her. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. We should be able to look at our spouse and say this, I know that you will always have my best interest in mind. Okay? You got that? You're going to say this, okay? So now learn it, all right? I know that you will always have my best interest in mind. Okay, if you're sitting by your married spouse, I want you to turn to them. Okay, so Bob, don't turn to Robert, all right? Okay, turn to your married spouse and repeat after me. Ready? I know that you will always have my best interest in mind. Were you telling the truth? Huh? What you laughing about, Ken? After being married to Jeannie 80 years, you should know that she has your best interest in mind, or she would have dumped you a long time ago. A marriage ought to be a safe place. A place that you're safe emotionally. A place where you're safe physically. A place where you're safe spiritually. A place where you can be you. And not have to fear the retribution or harm that might come. Finally, weaving is transformative. No, that's too big a word for Dan Leeds. It's not my word, you know that, but I read it someplace. Weaving is transformative. The person who wrote that said this, a good marriage, I have come to understand, is transformative. The prevailing psychological view has been that the central dimensions of personality are fully established in childhood. But from my observations, men and women come to adulthood unfinished. And over the course of a marriage, they are changed. They often change each other profoundly. The very act of living closely together for a long time brings about inner change, not just conscious accommodation. As men and women in good marriages respond to the partner's emotional and sexual needs and wishes, they grow and influence each other. The needs of one's partner and children become as important as one's own needs, ways of thinking, self-image, self-esteem and values all have the potential for change. You ever notice that couples that have just been together or are close together and been together for a long time start to look alike? Some of you are going to say, that's not true. I don't, but you know what? You both start looking like St. Bernards or Chihuahuas or something, you know? There's a certain truth to that. I've embraced this probably only in the last half dozen years. This importance of oneness. Therefore, that means that because I will change, Lynn must change too. And the reason I will change is I am not immutable God. I am not changeless. I am cursed by this sin nature, and therefore I will change, and it's not always good. But as I change and as Lynn changes, by the grace of God, we together become like Jesus Christ. And that is part of the weaving process, the oneness that we ought to have, that we would leave, cleave, and weave, that we would change together to be like Jesus. Therefore, oneness is transformative. It's radical. It changes us from who we are to who God would have us to be in that marriage. In that marriage. We're going to sing a song here. Jeremy's going to come up here, and we're going to sing, Change My Heart, O God. Change my heart, O God. Make it the way you would have it to be.